Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson, author of the first published investigation about the Post Office's Horizon IT system when I worked for Computer Weekly in 2009.
And I'm Nick Wallace, author of the book The Great Post Office Scandal. Today we're talking to Lee Castleton, one of the central characters in this story, and one of the postmasters who's helped lead the fight back against the Post Office. Rebecca, you interviewed him. What did you speak to Lee about?
So we talked about a few things. Firstly, I was interested in his take on why and how the scandal happened in the first place. So the organisational mindset that it takes and the culture or environment which would allow this kind of thing to happen. And I was also interested on Lee's take on the parallels between this and other institutional UK scandals like Grenfell and Windrush.
And now in your interview, Lee mentions a couple of people who were also instrumental in the fight. One is Alan Bates, the former postmaster who runs the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance. And he took the post office to the High Court in 2018.
Yes, and Lee also mentions Ron Warmington, who was part of Second Sight. They were the forensic accountants at the post office asked to investigate Horizon back in 2013. But their investigation was rubbish and dropped by the post office when Second Sight started to uncover serious problems, not just with Horizon, but with the way the post office went about investigating and prosecuting sub-postmasters.
And another person that Lee mentions is Mr. Justice Fraser. Now, this was the judge in the Bates v. Post Office High Court case who produced two swingeing judgments in the postmaster's favour. And that became a major turning point in their campaign and this whole scandal.
Finally, as Nick said, Lee is one of the central characters who brought this scandal to light over a period of nearly 20 years and at great personal cost. He suffered a bankruptcy and his family have suffered significantly as well. But throughout it all these personal consequences, Lee has kept talking to the media, kept fighting it, and is one of the main postmasters to have kept the whole thing on the road. When I spoke to him, I was interested in the strength of character that it takes to fight a scandal like this and the personal cost that it comes at. So I started by asking Lee how hard it is to be constantly telling and retelling his story and being in the media.
It's really tough, and emotionally as well it's really tough, but it's, you know, we kind of, as a group, we've probably made a decision, the group being my family, that we would just try and keep it out there because it would be easy to cave in and allow all those people that want it to go away. They just want it to go away, and there's too many people that were that we talk to, you know, if not daily, weekly, that are out of the group, that's are still struggling with life. I mean, for me, my life's kind of changed a little bit because I work in a good job, and you know, my wife works. We've managed to kind of turn the corner and change our lives a little bit. But it was really, really difficult for a long time. You know, for all four of us, really. Well, even deeper into the family than just four. I'm from a really big family. I'm one of seven. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so it hit the whole family pretty hard. And of course, living in a small fishing town, it was really difficult. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody. So to keep pushing it out there, it's not my ideal. You know, I'd much rather not speak to anybody about it ever again. It's certainly nothing that brings any good thoughts, really.
No. Do you mind telling me a bit about where you're at the moment? Because I understand that the compensation has changed slightly recently, and so is that change for the better for you in your, because you're in quite a unique situation?
Yeah. I mean, it was in a position where obviously mine was a civil case, which is quite unusual out of the group, and the group really is hugely diversified in all kinds of different actions that were taken, terrible actions that affected people so terribly badly. But my particular case was heard in the High Court, which was a civil case, and because of the group litigation, the GLO, that kind of finished any extra avenues for me. It was the end of the end, really. Even though the compensation itself was, you know, unbelievably bad, it was a line drawn under everything, and I was told repeatedly by, you know, various solicitors and people that there was no further avenues for me to explore. Malicious prosecution had been taken away from me, And I understand that because it was about 555 people, not just me. So now that's kind of evolved because the minister has made a decision along with Biz that they're going to compensate people properly. So that's opened up a new avenue for me and probably for a vast majority of the group too, which will allow us maybe to seek proper, fair compensation.
That is really good. And do you think that there's one particular moment where you felt this attitude shifting or changing? Is there one thing that you can attribute this change to, or is it more of a slow?
I really do believe it's the work behind the doors done by people like Alan Bates. Alan Bates has been immense throughout all this. It's probably a little bit, you know, what we see on the surface is just a tiny, tiny percentage of the vast amount of work that's being done, and the constant meetings and arguments I would imagine that he's having to progress himself through. And fair play to him, he's doing a great job.
I'd love to ask him one day, like, how did he keep going? How did you keep going?
I have no idea. Well, I remember trying to explain that a few years ago, saying, I haven't had a choice really, Rebecca. You know, some people have the opportunity maybe to draw a line under things personally and walk away. I've always been in the position when nothing's really, even now, nothing. The only changes that have happened in my life, really, financially and everything else, is brought about by myself and my family. Because the compensation that I received initially was tiny, you know, small, a very small drop in the ocean of the money that this has cost. And because of that, where we are now and how we've sort of mentally and physically dragged ourselves through all this mire is just about the personalities that surround me.
As in your family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and friends and people, you know, professional people that have helped me try to understand what really is going on. Because at the end of the day, you know, I'm just a layman. I'm not anybody with any legal experience or anything like that. So it's been really difficult to understand how we could have won the GLO and come out so badly, how people could just professionally, who had responsibilities to the group, as people of this world, this country, you know, they had responsibilities to make sure that people weren't allowed to do what they did to us. And all of those people were able to turn their backs initially. And thankfully, because of the hard work that's gone on in the background and in the media and everywhere else, I mean, God knows where we would have been. I would hate to think if people like yourself, I mean, I remember the first phone calls between yourself and myself all those years ago. And to think now that we're talking like this, and you know, I mean, it's just mind-bending, really.
It really is, isn't it? I do think as well. I mean, I think lots of people would have just been beaten by it and gone away and not talked and not sort of kept going. And I mean,
I have been beaten by it. You know, make no bones about that. I'm from where I was 17 years ago to where I am now. I am not the Lee Castleton of 2004.
No, of course. But I guess you are still here, and
yeah,
you're getting compensation finally, like, yeah, way longer than it should have done. But and you sort of say something quite interesting about the processing of it all as well, like the processing. I can imagine that's
constantly really trying hard to assess what. I'm not very good reading what people actually want me to think about things. I'm a very typical Yorkshireman, and I'm quite happy to be told. I'm quite happy to have the blunt end of the stick and sometimes hit over the head with the blunt end of the stick in order for me to take it in. And the little intricacies of the legal side and some of the other things that go on, I find really difficult. And I would find it a lot more easier if somebody just raised a finger to my face and said, this is how it is. But seemingly throughout all of this, when a line is drawn in the sand, that may not be the line that anybody doesn't pass over. It seems the craziest thing that people say, we can't do anything after that. But in actual fact, that then happens the following week. And I found that quite difficult to deal with and process and understand. I've also found that the hard things to process sometimes are the things that you think would be quite relatively easy. I remember talking to the police back in 2008, begging them to get involved and find out why the post office were able to do what they did initially to the smaller group, and then over the years what they continued to do. And it's quite difficult to have a conversation with a policeman who's obviously very under pressure with his workload and everything else, and to be ridiculed, really. It was kind of surreal. And my heart goes out to anybody who has to deal with that in any other way. And I've kind of got to a point now in my life, probably the last 3 years, certainly, where I know it's not going to, no one's going to speed anything up. No one's going to change anything quickly. There's no point in pushing as hard as you possibly can. You may as well just step back, save your energy, let it unfold, because everybody seems to have their own sort of way of dealing with things, and everyone seems to work at their own pace. And if biz take 10 years more, then they take 10 years more, and it won't be anything that Lee Castleman says that will change that.
Yeah, that's so true. You just, these things that are not in your control, it's best to accept that they're not. But it's also very true that those bureaucratic kind of legal, moving at the pace of a snail, those are the things that can get to people, you know. Like there's lots of examples of the state dealing with people in a way that is extremely hard to
I mean, there's people in our group currently right now really going through terrible times, you know, terrible times that aren't changing very quickly. And when you hear these genuine, just normal people trying to explain emotionally how their lives are still falling to pieces, and then that brings all the terrible thoughts of my life originally falling to pieces and watching things crumble around me, I wish it was over, and I wish it was dealt with, and I wish that everybody was in a better place. But I also know that no matter how painful the journey is going to be, just keep walking, because it's going to have to be walked.
Yeah, 100%. Do you feel as though there's anything, any kind of light at the end of any kind of tunnel? Are you starting to feel like you might, I mean, both personally and more broadly, for the rest of the group?
For me, I mean, for me personally, we're kind of in a better place than we've probably been in certainly 17 years. The family life is really quite nice at the moment. My two children have seemed to have really settled. My eldest, my daughter, is just completed training to be a teacher. I'm very, very proud.
Oh, amazing. Well done, her.
Yeah. And my son's a gastrointestinal engineer, so he's got his own business now. He's set up on his own, so that's wonderful as well. I'm very proud.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, so personally, I feel as though we're probably in a good place, you know, a good place, really. And in general, I just worry about accountability, really. I think there's some people out there that seem to think it's okay to do this to people. You know, and I think actually, sad as it may seem, it can be seen as being okay, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think the banks, other people, you know, tread all over people. The smaller person, the person that can't just dip into huge funds and get advice or whatever and have this massive protection all the time. And I believe that a lot of the protagonists of this are going to have some really good legal cover in place, and they'll probably mitigate a lot of the things that they've actually done.
Mm.
And there's not really a lot you can do with that.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's all sort of speculative, and who knows how it will play out, but it is a bit scary to think about, yeah, what will happen in the rest of the inquiry? Will, like you say, will any true accountability come out of it?
Yeah, I hope there is. I really do. And you know, I think people kind of mentally as well need to finalise things and draw a line of the things, whichever way, if there's no accountability and these people are able just to continue with their lives and continue with their professional lives as well, then so be it. That's where it will be. And it won't be anything yet again that Lee Castleton says that would change that. But the honesty for me would be that I think for the public, you know, for the general public, there needs to be a point at which people don't accept that and don't real, you know, in real terms, the general public deserve to have officers in place that deal with people properly. And I think sometimes you have to draw a line and say, we're not just going to let you walk away from that.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's one of the things that I'm really interested in, as well as the accountability. You know, are we going to learn lessons from what's happened? And it comes down to that way people have been treated and the way people are seen as sort of less than.
Absolutely.
And
without a doubt.
One of the things I wanted to ask you actually was whether you think there are similarities between this scandal and other scandals like Grenfell and Windrush. Obviously, the details.
Absolutely. Gosh, yes, without a doubt. You know, when you look through, there's so many things that strike you so hard. And emotionally, for me, I find it really difficult to read anything about Grenfell, particularly because some of the motivation behind the scenes is very dark, and you can read it without reading between the lines. You can actually read it, you know, and that makes it really hard to take, because people trust, you know, you trust your government and your people in power and your civil servants and the people that are trying to work for you. It's a funny thing that they always say they work for you. You know, when you go onto the parliamentary website and all that kind of thing. Wow. You know, it's just mind bending sometimes that it's really difficult to take when you look at the similarities and the way that people are treated in general. And it's so easy to treat somebody who's faceless. And that's one of the things probably the group have done really well, is Joe and everybody being out there, Seema and Janet and everybody getting out there and putting their face in the front of the camera and saying, I'm human, I'm just the person that ran the shop at the bottom of the road, and I don't deserve this. I'm, you know, I'm just trying to live my life. And I think that's where things became better for everybody. You know, things started to change in the media and things started to become more humanised. I think a lot of the civil servant sides of this would like everyone to become faceless and not tell a story, not tell how it affected all the family and the people around them, the people that care about, the people that love, and not tell anybody about anything personal. Because when you start talking emotionally and emotively about what's happened, you know, to say me and my family or any of the other group, you become a human again. And once you become a human again, it becomes very difficult to bury it. And that's what we've all set out to do, you know, to make it humanized again. Because it did become very legal and it did become very non-personal, and it needed to come back to the true part of this is, we are the people from the corner shop. You know, you say morning to every time you go in for a paper or a packet of tea bags or whatever.
Mm.
You know, and we needed to get back to that.
Yeah, that process of rehumanizing is very powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that I wanted to ask you while you were talking then. And yeah, that is so true. And that is definitely a common theme where in these scandals where people, like you say, the little people, the so-called.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true.
Effectively get dehumanized. And I don't know, for what? I don't quite know.
Don't you think it becomes easier to say, oh, we're doing the better good. We're doing the better good for this group, you know, for the whole nation. This is what we're doing. We're doing this the best way we can do it. But as soon as then you pick that one person, that one person's life, and you start to look into it and they become humanized, then you realize that it's not actually, you're not actually doing what's best. What you're doing is what's best for you or for the group of people that are probably the protagonists of it. So if you take that back to somewhere like Grenfell, you know, they were protecting or trying to protect nothing to do with the people that needed protecting, you know, and even now, if you look at our inquiry, some of the legal fees for some of the individuals on the higher spectrum of the companies a huge multi-million pound legal fees that are being granted by inquiry. And I know that inquiries are very expensive and I understand that things, but you know, I can sit here and talk to you about my own personal legal side, rightly or wrongly. I've got, you know, nothing to hide. People that go for very large guns in the shape of law firms, why would you need to do that? Why do you need to mitigate actions? Why do you need to destroy things that way? An inquiry really just should be about the truth.
Yeah, they're sort of still protecting their own interests.
Haven't they always?
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing that I thought was quite interesting with the parallel between Grenfell and Post Office was the element of profit chasing or profit that
the protection.
Profit protection played
yeah,
within
absolutely.
But within a public organisation. So maybe you don't have the same legal protections or governance in place that you might have in a private organization, a private business. So I worked at a retail magazine for a long time called Retail Week, and I was talking with my former colleagues the other day about were there any kind of similar scandals in the retail world which we didn't find. And there is definitely systemic injustice in retail, especially, you know, when you look at fashion supply chains and, you know, the workers in different countries and where all of our waste gets sent and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not sure if, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, we just didn't discover things, but I'm not sure if this kind of stuff happens in private corporations, partly because it is systemic and it's broader. But I do wonder if there's something around that kind of very focused on profit and money, but without the...
you know, years ago, probably in 2015, a gentleman that I hold in very high esteem, Ron Wilmington, said to me that he'd sat down with one of the board members of Post Office, and he had a long conversation that was quite argumentative in a way. And one of the things that struck him throughout the whole of it, and I'm sure that he won't mind me saying this, is the lack of commercial judgment. Because if you were a commercial company, all those years ago, you would have probably said, oh, hold on, what kind of can of worms are we making? Because let's face it, that's what we're talking about. There wasn't a can of worms back then. It was constructed, and it was constructed for commercial reasons. You know, the whole process of making that can of worms has cost the government ultimately, and arguably, obviously, the taxpayer, an immense amount of money, and a commercial organisation, be it from any stream of industry or commercial sort of basis, would never, I believe, they would never make that decision because money is not limitless. Whereas for a civil servant or a government-based, you tend to find that they do honestly believe that they can just buy that out of anything. You know, throw enough money at it and it'll disappear. Because I know one of the things that we discussed prior to the GLO was the bottomless funds that were going to be thrown at, which were proved. You know, millions of pounds were spent trying to recuse a judge, even though the judge in law, anybody who read those judgments would not have ever dreamed that he was being biased or needed. And what a great guy. I mean, Judge Fraser, immense. The judgments, everything, the outcome, absolutely immense. To sit, the first time I sat in the court there, to watch him deal with the case, you knew right from there, not that we were winning or anything like that, it was just the way that you knew the truth was going to come out. You know, he was taking none of this sort of legal shenanigans. It was direct. Being a Yorkshireman, I really appreciate that, you know. And you could see that he'd served in the Marines, and he was very much a leader, very much a man of his own mind. And he knew what he wanted to achieve. He knew what information he needed to achieve that. And he was quite intent on getting that information. And that was the first time in all of those years that I'd actually seen somebody in front of me who were determined and had the tools, actually had the opportunity to get that information, because everybody else had been frustrated or, you know, when Second Sight, who are absolutely technically immense, great people, hardworking, were frustrated and frustrated and frustrated by the board. That was never going to happen in the court of law. And that was a huge change for the group. It was huge, mammoth. And, you know, I doffed my cap to him.
Yeah.
What a guy.
Yeah, so he's the first person, I guess, in a position of real power who
ended
up being on, coming down on your side. That must have been a huge sort of psychological turning point, because it certainly was. I think in the way that it was treated in the media, you know, it was the point where really everyone started believing you.
Yeah, definitely. I think prior to that, there'd been not really a lot of disclosure. So whilst everyone believed in the group that there would be documents and things out there that would prove our case, the physicality of actually owning those documents was few and far between. There wasn't really an awful lot of actual black and white information there. And even then, there's been an awful lot of disclosure. Even disclosure wasn't very good in the GLO. You know, it's been proven that there's been various documents that have been sat on and hidden and maybe even destroyed. It's been mentioned. To get to the point where there was firm black and white evidence that was taken on board by a professional forensic court-appointed gentleman, then it just took it out, you know, another level, really. It was like the vindication, the understanding, finally, the frustration of not being understood was removed. And there's been very little talk about since 2019, because Fraser was so thorough and so demonstrative of the actual facts, that since 2019, I don't think anyone's actually revisited all of the parts of his judgment that deal with the evidence that were given. And now when you look at the extra evidence, even more disclosure, you know, it kind of cements everything that he put out there in the judgment. I think it's immense. You know, it was certainly a huge turning point for the group. You know, it meant amazing. But to have that, there's very few people probably that have that acumen, that understanding, that legal kind of standing that Fraser showed in the way that he dealt with everything. Post office spent millions upon millions upon millions of pounds. And no commercially minded person would have ever set down that road to do what they did, unless they felt that they could just outspend and crush the argument by our side not having any more money to continue. Thankfully, we got to a point where we could draw a line and move away from that, because they were, you know, they're quite happy to outspend. I think £100 million over the whole process was spent, which is, you know, how many commercial organisations would want to spend £100 million trying to defend something that they actually have already previously advised, you know, legal advice, to say that maybe they were already wrong anyway.
It's mind-boggling.
Why would they not just?
That's why nobody does it in commercial, you know, businesses.
Yeah,
if you have
they can't
to,
afford to.
No, oh God.
Quite
can
aside from the
board and saying,
God, it is my
I've just blown £120 million of our profits defending something that I know to be undefendable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does. It does happen. You know, big. Big injustices do happen in the corporate world, 100%. But I do, I mean, it certainly hasn't happened to this degree in the last, you know, 10, 20 years in the UK. The scandals that I can think of anyway have been state.
I think commercial, you know, legal funding has changed in such a way that, you know, it's kind of made the little one a little bit stronger. In a way, I know that there's been a lot of changes in that, and I know that it's a very expensive way of funding something. And Ethereum were very, very good to us as a group in the way that they funded us. And you know, again, at least we were able to do what we did in court. And if we hadn't had that avenue, we would not be sat here today talking about the 2019 outcome and how everything's changed and being able to put pressure on biz, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, thank goodness. And I guess as well, Fraser was the first to question the IT. Is that fair enough to say? So many judges just accepted if an expert witness said, yes, it works, that was it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And to be fair, that is pretty much the way the law reads it. You know, if you've got nothing in there to say that there's a fault, and then it's assumed that it's working correctly. That was a change, I believe, in something like 1996. There's been some quite interesting, very interesting papers about electronic evidence. Stephen Mason and Paul Marshall have given evidence to the government on that very thing. And hopefully that will change, because the way that unfolds for, like myself in the very original case, or Seema in her case, it becomes the impossible task, because you don't actually have full access to the system personally. And because you don't have access to the full system personally, you can't really interrogate it to prove whether it was working. And also, it's right at that time, you know, when you were using it. So it makes it really difficult to prove. Whereas previously, I might be wrong here, but I believe that they had to prove that it was working correctly, which made the people with all of the information having to prove that their machine worked correctly, and therefore, why did it not work, or why did you have an issue? So the evidence in law really needs in my opinion, needs to change.
Is there any aspect of this scandal or this story which you would like to see discussed more?
Yeah, I'd like to see a little bit more about the corporate governance side, really. There's been a few things put out there about, you know, whether it's right or wrong to do what they did, basically. And there's obviously legislation there. There's all of the requirements under the company law and directorships and all that kind of thing. And I think at the moment it seems quite easy to hide behind third parties, really. You'll probably notice a lot of the decisions were taken when you read through by subcommittees, not the whole board. So some people are aware of part of it, and other people are aware of another part. And it can, you know, not. And I don't know whether this is the case or not, but I always feel as though people kind of take pieces, little pieces of information out of context, and then produce it to somebody else in a positive way or in a negative way to change an outcome somewhere. And I think that when the whole details of the post office matter is probably looked at forensically through the boardroom side. I think that occurred on numerous occasions, and I'd like to see some accountability there, really, and maybe even some changes in rules, so that and maybe even a little bit more stricter application of the rules that are already there, because it would seem that it's quite acceptable for certain people to do certain things, you know, so directors, because they're protected probably by multi-million pound packages of salary, also probably insurance in place for any litigation or anything, or any legal sort of cover. And because of that, it almost becomes okay for people to act terribly and actually mislead. You know, there's certainly been cases with post office directors that have given false evidence, obviously, in my opinion. I've got to put that caveat in there, apparently. I've learned that's my small part of legal training, Rebecca, for 17 years, in my humble opinion.
I think it works. I think you're covered. I mean, I feel like as long as we're not naming anyone, we're all good. Use the word allegedly every so often.
Allegedly, yes, without a doubt. But certainly, when you look back at some of the evidence, there's some people that, in my opinion, give false facts to various courts and inquiries. And when you look back at the Select Committee in particular, to actually sit in Parliament and give false facts, and mislead to your employers at the end of the day, something's got to be done. Something has to be done. You know, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable in public life. And I think that's where people need to look.
Yeah, definitely. And just how can we be sure that this isn't going to happen again?
Yeah.
Next time, Sam.
Well, if there's punishment there, if there is, if there were to be, I think it would be a very large deterrent. I really do. I think it's not acceptable to hide behind a company's face as a personal person making personal decisions when you're an officer of that company. And I think it's very important that those people are outed. And when they're outed, punished accordingly. You know, if it's a prosecution or whatever it might be, then, you know, I'm not asking for loads of people to go to jail. That's not what, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. What I'm asking for is a true and just outcome, you know, real accountability in real lives for real people.
Yeah, well, I think that's completely fair enough. What's next for you, Lee? What are your plans? I mean, when do you get your compensation? Do you know yet? Have you had a date? Or
I've not even had my interim as yet.
Oh, really?
Because mine's really complicated, yeah. I've not had any feedback from Freeth with respect to my interim. So obviously I have a bankruptcy in there, so I would imagine that's what's holding it off, and I'm sure they're doing whatever they need to do. I don't know how much it would be. I don't know whether it would be life-changing with respect to compensation or not. I don't know. I really don't know. I can only say that everything's just moving forward, really, very slowly. I emailed Imogen at Freeze this morning just to keep up to date with things. And I don't know whether it'll change my life or not. I would really like it to get a bit easier.
Yeah.
If I'm truthful.
I really
would. It'd be nice. Yeah. It'd be nice to have a few pounds in savings and things, and, you know, but it is what it is.
After 17 years, I would say you deserve that.
It'd be nice for the kids and obviously for Lisa, my wife, bless her. It's been a hard journey. I think probably out the whole thing for me, the hardest thing, you know, as you know, I'm a big, ugly guy, and at the end of the day, you can do what you want to me, you know, but to watch the family is really difficult.
That was Lee Castleton, one of the people I interviewed for my very first piece on this scandal back in 2009. It was great to speak to him again, and thank you, Lee, for speaking to us. We really appreciate it.
We will be back soon with more interviews to chew over. Don't forget, you can read more about this scandal on the website postofficescandal.uk.
And if you would like to, you can also sign up to my free Substack newsletter. You just need to search for Rebecca Thompson Substack, and there's no P in Thompson.
I refuse to take the P. Please also like, subscribe and follow this podcast on Spotify, Amazon or Audio Boom if you'd like to get each new episode freshly delivered to your ears. Or please just spread the word to your friends and other interested parties.
You have been listening to Investigating the Post Office Scandal, which is supported by Whistledown Productions. We're very grateful to them for their use of their studio and their broadcast know-how, although we are researching, producing and editing the podcast ourselves.
We'll see you next time.
Bye. Bye.